My Muscle Project, welcome back to another episode. Today is special because today marks, assuming that you're listening to this live, today marks the official day that we are in our new studio for 2019. It has been a long time coming. We could not be more excited. There is going to be so much new content, so many more guests. We've got the overseas trip book in March. We have another trip book in July as well, which we'll come to at a later stage. You've got the videographer, photographer. It's all happening at My Muscle Project HQ. We're just pumped, guys. We're pumped. So stay close to the Instagram and you will see updates. We're going to do some tours. We're going to do walkthroughs in the new studio, the whole office, how the whole situation's working, because it's a massive space and it's got tons of awesome facilities. So make sure you're tuning in to check all that stuff out. Today on the show, we have Gabrielle Fundero, and she is from Renaissance Periodization. If that rings a bell, that's right. Last week, we had Mike Israetel from the same company. So Gabrielle is one of the coaches there. She is a doctor. And today's focus is on evidence-based science on the gut. Now, it's funny because the gut is such a popular topic, but it has very, very squirrely sort of science and a lot of weirdos and spectrum people talking about gut and gut this and gut that with not a lot of science to back it up. And so Gabrielle is that person to kind of bust all those myths and really give us what is the truth and what is the actual science saying and where we're at with it. And, you know, do probiotics help the gut? Do we need them? Do we not need them? Which of those probiotics do we need? Like, are there single ones inside of that whole spectrum that we could just, you know, pick one out and use that, and how all these effects work? And so it's a really, really interesting conversation, and I think one that we haven't really had as in-depth before, so we're pumped to bring it to you, and I just know you guys are going to love it. Good segue into that, guys. Activated nutrients, they are taking care of your gut health as well. All the stuff inside of that, over 50 whole food vitamins and minerals. Delicious, goes really well with a smoothie, goes well by itself with water. I did some traveling recently. I didn't have a lot of sleep. I wasn't recovering very well, but it kept me sharp. It kept me awake. And you know what? You don't always need to have coffee, I find, if you're having activated nutrients. So if you feel like you're a person that's highly addicted to caffeine and you're trying to like wean yourself off a little bit, adding in some extra activated nutrients, maybe going a double scoop, maybe going a triple scoop, you know, in the morning, in the evenings, that's going to really help balance out your energy levels and kind of stop those headaches and just kind of keep things a little more even keel and not such a heavy spike for those of you that are really into coffee. So if you guys are keen, I've recommended now for a long time getting the subscription. That's really easy. You get the 20% off. It's less than $1 a day for a serve, and it's always there, so you never run out. So if you go to activatednutrients.com and you pick any product that you like, the top up or the grown up, the one for the adults or the ones for the children, the male, the female product, whatever you guys choose, you can choose the subscription option. Go for that. That gets you 20% off at activatednutrients.com. If you just want to pick anything else up, use the code OFFERMMP for the first time, and that will get you 20% off as well. And guys, also to balance out everything, we need a perfect lifestyle. We need a perfect training routine. We need a good diet. And we need a good coaches to go with both. Now, many of you have probably got coaches, but do you have a coach for your nutrition? You eat way more than you train. And so if you've got someone helping you out there, you're probably going to get more benefit from that than someone that's, you know, only with you for half an hour, for an hour watching you train. So if you're looking for someone to coach you and guide you and help you with your nutrition, keep it balanced, keep it sustainable, then you need to work with Matt from beyondmacros.com. So if you go to Beyond Macros, you go to the website, you can sign up and get a free consultation with any of the coaches, and they will basically walk you through kind of where you're at, what your goals are, where you need to go, and how they can help you along the way. So we love Matt. We've worked with him before. Raf has got some incredible results with him based off his original calorie recommendations and some tweaks that I made. I got pretty damn close. I got 99.8 kilos in body weight. So 200 grams short of my 100 kilo body weight goal in 100 days. And it was because he, you know, really helped me out and gave me some insight as to, you know, what my body needs, a little bit more carb, a little bit less fat, high protein, and a lot of calories. So some really good wisdom in there. BeyondMacros.com. When you sign up, when you get a consultation with Matt, make sure that you let him know that we sent you, and he'll give you a good little deal. All right, that's it, guys. Episode 228 with Gabrielle. This is Lachlan Rouston.
This is Raph Friedman, and you're listening to the fittest podcast in Australia,
The Mind Muscle Project. All right, My Mox Project. Welcome back to another episode of the podcast. Today, we're joined by the second member of the Renaissance Periodization team, and this may be one of many to come. Mm-hmm. So it's awesome to be connecting with more of you guys. Today, we have on Dr. Gabrielle Fundera, and she is a coach on RP and works with Mike, and obviously together they work on different stand-up comedy sets that they can deliver to different podcasts. But in all seriousness, Gab is an awesome coach and delivering some great results for the clientele at RP. And RP, if I'd say by now, it's got to be at least in the top five online nutrition coaching companies in the world. Like, you guys are just absolutely massive. You tour, you go on lots of different shows, you put out great content. And I think what's really cool about today is just kind of, we get a little of criticism sometimes. We don't get a lot of a female voice about the industry.
Valid criticism, unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely. So it is really nice to have you on, Gab, to talk about this stuff. I thought probably the best place to start for the listeners would be just how you got your sort of start in the industry, and then eventually how you ended up connecting with RP.
Yeah. This is actually, my dad used to say, luck is where preparation meets opportunity, and that's sort of how my life has really gone. I was in academia. I was an assistant professor for just over 4 years and had a very small social media presence. I don't know if you could even call it that. I had a blog, and I posted on Facebook and things like that. And Mike actually found me via social media and really liked the content that I was putting out. So we discussed me joining RP. And so for the first year that I was coaching with RP, I had a pretty small client load because I was still teaching full time. But I was able to, be very prudent about my spending and saved enough that I could support myself, if like the shit really hit the fan for 6 months or so. And I blogged about this too. In one of my blogs, Know When to Start and Know When to. So I've talked about it a little bit before, but at the end of that year, I actually resigned and transitioned to coaching full time, with plans to earn my RD credential midway through right now, and then be able to take on even more clients. And then obviously traveling a lot. I have been, as you mentioned, you guys don't have necessarily as much female representation. And I think that's just something that's sort of a symptom of the industry itself, is that we don't have quite as much female representation. And so I do want to serve as sort of a female representative of RP that, travels around and is skeptical and evidence-based and really no BS. I don't promote supplements and things like that. I really try to represent the research with the most integrity that I can and the least amount of bias. So it's really been wonderful to be able to pursue that. I mean, that's been a dream of mine for a really long time. I used to joke with my students that, someday I'd like be a New York Times bestseller and like get to debate Food Babe or something, because such garbage all the time. She just doesn't know what I get, but maybe someday. So it was just, I had the credentials at that point, and I was prepared to take the opportunity that presented itself. And so now it's just daily grind. Like, it's not that, coaching full time and working from home is like, oh, you don't have to work. But, that's what people think. Same thing with teachers. Like, when I taught, they'd be like, oh, you get the summers off. No, the summer is just when you have more time to do more work. But it's awesome. I love it.
Yeah, that's cool. How have you found, now I could be wrong, but I assume that a lot of the clients that you coach on RP is remote. You don't do a lot of it in person. How have you managed to balance? Obviously, seminars and stuff are in person, which is great, but how have you managed coaching, mostly online and obviously through the internet, these sort of calls versus kind of an in-person version of it?
Yeah. I actually went through the process of earning my certified health coach credential. So we have American Council on Exercise. They do this credential that really helps you to learn how to do effective behavioral, motivational interviewing to facilitate behavior change in clients. And so a lot of that actually does lend itself pretty well to online email formats, because you have time to really think about how to craft your message in the best way so that your client is validated and heard, and that you're really addressing, you know, perhaps the underlying message there that they may not be saying, you know, directly, but you can kind of get a sense of what's actually going on, you know, and ensure that even though it's a remote coaching, that they still have a very personal coaching experience, that you develop rapport with them. RP does actually do, we do phone consults now as well. And that's something I've done phone and Skype consults separately from RP, just through my own. I have like kind of a vitamin PhD. That's my tag on like Instagram and whatnot. And so I like that because, you know, you still get the face to face. But even over the phone, you know, there's more of a sense of kind of like personality and you know, context and whatnot with what you're saying. But I think that it also lends itself to, you know, a lot more flexibility, which is nice because you can kind of, you know, as long as we're responding within 24 hours, you know, that's something that's really important. But for the sake of clients, too, you know, maybe it's hard for them to meet in person. And so they can enjoy, you know, that added level of flexibility. But it's not necessarily going to be appropriate for every person. And I think that's another thing that is important to realize. And that's coaching, whether you're doing it in person or online, is that not every coach is a good fit for every client. You know, depending on your coaching style, you know, you may be more of an inspirational coach or cathartic or something. And, you know, if you really get into people's emotions and things like that, sometimes people, you know, that doesn't vibe with them, and that's totally fine. And they want to have just a little bit more, you know, give me a plan and then I'll check in with you. And so I think that that's possible to apply to whether you're doing something in person or online.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. What are some like basic, you know, because this is, you know, us having done coaching for a long time as well. This is obviously a very important skill. What you realize over time is that change is very, very difficult, especially if someone is a little bit older and maybe the incentives to change is to just be healthier. Everyone knows they need to be healthier and move a bit more and lose some weight and that sort of thing. But, you know, they're not as motivated as a young athlete that might be like, you know, I'm trying to, you know, win a bodybuilding show. I'm trying to, you know, I've got a powerlifting meet coming up. You know, that's obviously very strong motivators to have people change or have a purpose for change. So how do you go about changing just the everyday client that's like, hey, I just want to be healthier. I heard about you guys. My friend told me about you. My husband, my wife told me about you. How do you, you know, structure conversations to get them to make these sort of changes after them honestly having not changed for a long time?
Yeah. I actually will be talking about this. I've got a seminar coming up in Israel at the end of this month, and I'll be talking about some of the theories behind behavior change and how understanding these behavior change theories and different styles of motivation can actually help you help your clients more effectively. So in a lot of cases, clients might come to us thinking that, you know, they want to maybe just lose weight or look better or get healthier. And that's a great starting point, but it can really help to come up with sort of a, help them come up with a deeper why. Okay, you want to lose weight. What will that do for you? What are your bigger reasons for wanting to lose weight? If you were to lose 10 pounds, how would that affect all other facets of your life? Or if you have a client that's coming to you because it's maybe out of necessity, maybe they feel shame about their body, or they're worried about their spouse not being attracted to them, or their doctor told them their cholesterol levels are too high and they have to get in shape. Realizing that those are actually more external or extrinsic motivators, and they're not going to be effective in the long term. And in that case, you want to help the client shift to more of an internal or intrinsic type of motivation or regulation. So some of the most effective forms of motivation or intrinsic motivation are the types of motivation that arise when we identify like as an athlete. I mean, in a lot of cases, if you have a person who's been an athlete their whole lives, that's just they do these things because that's part of their identity. Or they just do them because they enjoy them. And so that type of intrinsic motivation, you know, can be good or bad. People enjoy sitting on the couch and like not exercising. You can be intrinsically motivated to do that because it's enjoyable, but that's not necessarily a habit that, you know, we want to maintain for a long time. So by helping them identify different whys, that can shift that motivation from the extrinsic of, I feel like I have to do this, to more of an intrinsic, more of an motivation of, this is good for me, I enjoy this. I am a person who exercises. I'm a person who likes to exercise. I am a fit person. And that helps to ingrain those habits so that they become more of that person's identity. Because these extrinsic motivators of, you know, shame or even like, you know, the office is having like a big challenge, that might work for a short period of time, but it's not going to lead to lasting kind of dedication or commitment to that change. So I think that's one of the biggest things is, you know, helping them find their big why. And I do this with a lot of my clients, especially, you know, when things, some of them, you know, we start right off the bat and they're really, they want to do that. Others, you know, I'm not going to force them to be so, you know, have this big project just starting out, like, oh, write this paragraph on, you know, reflecting on your whys. And as we go on, sometimes, you know, the scale stalls, they don't feel like they're making consistent progress, they have a lot going on and they're stressed out. That's a good time to say, hey, you know, you have the agency to decide whether you want to continue this or not. If you want to continue, let's look at how that might affect you. And if not, let's look at how that might affect you. And then start to help them uncover, oh, it's not just about losing 10 pounds. It's about feeling more confident. It's about being a role model for my kids. And it's about living longer and spending more time with my family. That is one of really the most effective things that I've seen. And I get really positive feedback from my clients when they take the time to do that.
Hmm. And do you think there's a big difference between behavior change in terms of your diet and behavior change in terms of your training? Just because I do find with diet, it's like, really affects you, like the way you feel and everything like that. And they're just kind of different things.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think a lot of trainers have probably heard of like the trans-theoretical model of change, where people can be sort of at different phases of readiness. Like some people might be just thinking about they want to make a change or, you know, they've been in the action phase. They've been making a change for 6 months or things like that. And we can be in two different phases at once. So you may have a person who has tracked macros for a really long time and, you know, they have a really good command of their diet, but they haven't started exercising. Maybe they don't really like exercise or they haven't found a modality that they enjoy, or vice versa. I think a lot of people, you know, they can be active and go to the gym and whatnot, but like, what's the hardest part? You know, getting your diet right. And, and you know, people are like, oh, abs are made in the kitchen and not in the gym. Arguably, you need both. But, you know, like it's when it comes to changing your diet, I mean, I think it really is person specific, because if you have a person who, you know, and I think a lot of it is how people are brought up as well. Maybe you're brought up in a family that didn't necessarily value, you know, nutrient dense foods and they didn't exercise regularly, or maybe, you know, you were a student athlete, so they really pushed sports, but you kind of ate just whatever was there because you needed a lot of calories. Mm. And then, you know, you graduate college, still eating like an athlete, but you're not really exercising. And now you just don't know exactly how to get command of your diet. So I really think, you know, that it's person specific. And I think, you know, some of the challenge too is that a lot of people have an idea of, you know, what are quote unquote healthy foods or nutritious foods. And so they eat those things, but they may not be getting the results that they want, because at the end of the day, weight management, weight control comes down to, you know, energy balance. So calories in versus calories out. And it's not that there are magic foods that you can eat to lose weight or foods that you should be eating to lose weight or not. It's just that, you know, yeah, if you're eating a lot of nutrient dense foods, that's great, but you can definitely overconsume olive oil and nuts and, you know, healthy carbohydrates and things like that. So I think that's probably one thing where people are confused, is that, you know, even if they are eating these nutritious foods, they still have to be cognizant of how much they're eating in some way, whatever way works for them.
Mm. Yeah, I definitely found that. I don't know about you, Raph, as well, but we trained a lot more than what we do now. The intensity is probably relatively similar, but the volume is changed dramatically. And yeah, changing habits that you've built for so long, you know, 4 or 5 years of just eating a lot of food regularly and a lot of supplements, it's just one of those things where you have to start to realize, like, my appetite for that stuff is still there, but my training load is nowhere near as much. And especially now, we're not on our feet as much. We sit at the desk more. It's just like, you can see these bad, well, then they were good habits at one phase of your life, and now they're bad habits. So it's like, it's the same thing, but all of a sudden, it's like, not a positive thing for your body. And it's like, I need to really reel this in. I need to be a bit careful, because this could get out of control.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because people don't keep in mind necessarily like their NEAT, you know, their non-exercise activity thermogenesis. Mm. I mean, when that falls off, it's just the weight really creeps on, and it's so sneaky, it's so insidious. It's like, you know, if you're just getting a few hundred calories extra per day, that's going to be just barely noticeable. It's sort of, you know, I don't know if you've seen the analogy of like peeling off sheets of paper towel, and that's how fat loss works. You know, you don't notice it day to day, but then all of a sudden you have an empty roll of paper towel. Like, oh, wow, you've lost so much fat. Same thing goes with putting it back on. You know, if you do it at a slow enough rate, you almost don't notice it until it's like, oh man, now it's a year later and maybe you're up 10 pounds. And, you know, it just seems like so much more of a slog to try and take it back off afterwards, which I think is part of the reason why we see, you know, even if people do have successful weight loss initially, that they regain and then they have a much harder time losing it again. And so there's a national weight control registry that tracks people who are successful weight losers. And one of the biggest factors in not being able to maintain your weight is how much you gain when you relapse. So if you do relapse and you gain an appreciable amount of weight, you probably will never be able to get back down to that previous amount that you had lost to.
Just talking about that as well, like on the subject of sort of fluctuating weight, obviously a thing that's like very common in training is, you know, people will go, okay, I want to, you know, bulk up a little bit now. I'm going to try and, you know, be in a calorie surplus, add a little bit more muscle. Obviously, realize it's going to come with a little bit more body fat, but that's okay because, you know, in the warmer months, I'm going to strip it back a little bit and I'm going to lean up a bit. And then the theory or the hope over time is that you maintain a relatively low body fat year round and that you're just constantly increasing or improving your body composition and by increasing sort of your overall body weight. That's pretty common for most gym goers for quite a long time. Do you think that that's a good approach to kind of go with forever almost in a way? Or do you feel like at some point it needs to move to like, look, let's just focus on maintenance and focus on health? Or can you do that forever?
I don't think that you would be able to indefinitely go through cutting and bulking cycles. And really, that's not what we recommend. We do recommend that we take maintenance breaks regularly. And maintenance, you know, there's a great account that I follow on Instagram, M. Blake, his name is Miguel. He's associated with Team Revive Stronger. And he made an Instagram post months ago and said that your diet should teach you habits. So whether you're cutting, whether you're bulking, you should be learning habits. And so it's really the change between, you know, maintenance and cutting and bulking is largely caloric intake. And it's not that, you know, you go ham during maintenance or your bulking phases and don't track anything and just eat as much of whatever you want for as long as you want. And then cutting, you restrict excessively. It's that you should be learning habits about how to do these things sustainably. So, you know, but you can't, I don't think you can really forever and ever go through cutting and then you bulk and then you cut again. You do have to take times for maintenance. I think also that maintenance helps us learn an important an important dissociation between progress coming from the scale moving. Sometimes it's very important to see the scale not move, because weight maintenance is what people in most cases have a really hard time with. And we're talking, when we talk about Gen Pop, you know, yeah, they do want to have like an improved body composition, but they're probably never going to want to get like stage lean or gain, you know, the maximum amount of muscle mass that they possibly can. They just want to probably, you know, look good naked, be healthy, and you know, improve, but like they want to not regain whatever weight they've lost. So if we never take time to learn how to maintain and moderate, so that includes having, I like to use the term free meal instead of cheat meal, because we're not cheating anything. You know, it's just, it's a treat, it's extra, it's something that you don't necessarily track, but being able to include those things without having this absent effect where it's, oh, I ate something that was bad, now I'm just going to eat what, you know, like garbage for the rest of the day, and because I blew it all anyway. And that's something that's really common. I've seen it in more so in my female clients than male clients, but it's just this feeling of it has to be 100% or 0%, all or nothing. That's entirely unsustainable. So when cutting, yes, we may need to be more restrictive. and in bulking, you know, maybe a little bit more lax, but we still have to do that in a planned way so that we're optimizing, you know, the ratio of muscle to fat, although the ratio of fat is still going to be greater than the ratio, the amount of fat is going to be greater than the amount of muscle. Mm. But during maintenance, we learn how to include those free meals, how to become a little bit more lax, not so rigid, and just sit with that same body weight. So we remove that necessity of an external reward of, oh, I'm seeing the scale go up or down. The scale's doing nothing. And instead, I'm focusing on my habits. I'm focusing on a sustainable lifestyle. I'm focusing on enjoying the process, not striving every couple days or every week for a weight change. And I think that's something that, you know, we really lose sight of in this constant movement towards body change. Sometimes it's important to maintain. And especially, you know, after a bulking cycle, we need to maintain, help to ensure that we aren't immediately then losing that newly accrued muscle mass. And then between cutting phases, you know, if someone has an appreciable amount of weight to lose, we don't want them to be dieting for an entire year. They diet for a period of time, then they maintain, and then they diet again.
And what? How much time would you set as sort of minimums and maximums for that cutting and maintaining and cutting, maintaining?
Yeah. We usually recommend about 12 weeks for a cutting cycle, and then about 75 to 100% of that or more for the maintaining in between. And the same thing for mass to maintenance. You probably could go, you know, if you cut down to a lean enough body composition, so where you're primed to gain the most amount of muscle mass with the least amount of fat mass, although that ratio is still going to be about probably 25 to 75% muscle to fat mass. Then you could, you know, probably go into a bulk after that. But I think the only risk with that is sort of just in terms of mentality, you've been cutting for so long, it probably is still a good idea to kind of ease into things because you may have increased appetite and it may be harder for you to, and this can be the case for maintenance too, it can be hard to come back in sort of a structured way so that we're not saying, oh, okay, now you're restricted for all that time. Now you just eat whatever you want. We're slowly increasing calories and reintroducing those really tasty foods in amounts that you can still, sort of self-regulate, keeping in mind that there are some, you know, psychological changes and physiological changes that occur during dieting that really increase our thoughts about food and our propensity to eat hedonically. So that's eating just, you know, because it tastes good. You're full, you don't want to eat anymore, but you just like somehow your, you know, ancillary stomach opens up and then you can just stuff more down in there.
plenty of room for Cocoa Pops in that area down there.
Yeah, exactly.
It's funny. I almost like just when you said the 12 weeks thing. Like, we're currently chasing down some body composition goals, and me personally going through a weight gaining phase, and it's been about 12 weeks at this point, and this is probably a good segue into maybe the gut piece, but I basically have had anything that really goes into my stomach after being in such a heavy surplus for the last 12 weeks, like start getting rejected and like indigestion, pain, like pretty much the only thing, not severe, but just like not normal to, you know, where it's like, okay, maybe it was that food or maybe it was this combination or maybe I didn't sleep right or maybe I'm training too much. And then you put something really simple in and you're like, okay, there's a bit of an issue here. So it's like everything I eat is not really going well. And that's kind of coincided with a real curbing of my appetite. You know, the appetite was really good. It was going up and things were quite comfortable. And then all of a sudden it's just kind of shit itself. And I feel like it's almost a forced maintenance phase and I kind of cut everything back and reset and it's a lot better. But then again, it's like, we still have a few weeks to go. So I want to kind of keep it in the surplus. Do you think I could be doing damage at this point? Or do you have an idea of maybe what's going on? Have you heard this stuff before? And is it like, you know, you need to maintain for a bit, you need to, you know, cut the surplus, you know, what do you feel like is going on there?
I have heard a lot about, and this is usually a good thing, in most people who are bulking, we hear about like their mass poops. So it's like, you know, when you're in an energy deficit, when you're dieting, your gut will actually slow down. And that is to increase the potential for nutrient absorption. And so people will usually experience constipation late in a cut, or, you know, just very low volume of stool as well. So stool is, you know, it's primarily water. We have some fiber in there. We also have some bodily proteins, and waste products and things like that. But, you know, the lower volume of food that you're eating and the less fiber that you're taking in, you can have really low stool volume and constipation. It gets pretty uncomfortable. But people who are massing, you know, you won't necessarily have that same issue. You probably, you know, like you're experiencing, could have increased gut motility or contractions of the gut, because part of what causes activity in our gut is just distension or stretching of the stomach and stretching of the intestines. So if you're putting in huge, huge amounts of food and you're causing a lot of distension, you're really activating nerves that move food through your GI tract. So that could be one thing. But when you talk, when you think about things like bloating and gas and you know, like increased, really, really increased transit and loose stools and things like that, then you're looking at, you know, there are a lot of different potential issues that could be going on there. One, with really increased, like if you have really high fiber intake, you know, if you're doing a bulk with a lot of nutrient dense foods, sometimes over up to about 70 grams of fiber per day, that's really when you can start to see some gastric upset effects. So that fiber, it's, I don't want to cast fiber in a negative light at all. It's great for digestion, it's great for cardiovascular health. But a lot of fiber can lead to the production of gases, which can interfere with transit of stool through the intestines, also cause bloating, and also actually even influences the bacteria that are producing short-chain fatty acids. So those short-chain fatty acids can change the acidity of the inside of your intestines as well. And so that can also have effects in, you know, stool quality and even the microbiome. So it's sort of a delicate balance of, you know, it's a Goldilocks. You don't want to have too little fiber. You don't want to have too much fiber. You have to have just the right amount of fiber because those bacteria are just so finicky, and just small changes can really affect the ecosystem that you have there. The other option is that perhaps you are regularly ingesting a food that, even if it is a nutritious food, may be something that you're not tolerating well. And again, this is in most cases because it contains one of these easily fermentable fibers or lactose. In some cases, people can tolerate these up to a given amount, but then you get too much. And then, like I said, you know, that Goldilocks effect. So it could be that, you know, if you're taking it in moderate amounts, you're fine. But then once you start increasing your intake to get your calories up, that's when you start seeing the issues.
I've had that experience with Quest bars.
Yeah.
Fine once a day and then three times a day. Yes. Fucked.
That's the sugar alcohols. And sugar alcohols, they're part of a group we call FODMAP. So they're these fermentable saccharides. And sugar alcohols, so things like erythritol, maltitol, xylitol, anything that ends in an "ol," very easily fermentable. They usually come with a warning that, like, they can have a laxative effect. And yeah.
Not lie. It's not a lie.
Yeah, it's not. It's very accurate. more sensitive to those than others. And also some are more irritating than others. More, you know, so you'll have effects at lower levels of certain sugar alcohols.
But yeah, I have seen people before, like you mentioned, where they think they're, like, intolerant of a food because they're like, oh, like, I don't feel good, I'm eating too much. But then when they just ate less fiber, it kind of all went away. And they weren't actually intolerant of the food, it's just the fiber amount was wrong.
Yeah, and yeah, so these food intolerance tests, these IgG food intolerance tests, are not valid. There's actually I can never remember what this acronym stands for, the IAAA. It's like Immunology and Allergenist Association. But they have actually issued a statement that the IgG food sensitivity tests are not valid. They cannot do what they claim to do. They cannot diagnose food allergies. The way that you would diagnose food allergies, you could do it a couple different ways, but you'd have to look at IgE antibodies. And really the only definitive way to determine a food allergy is that you have an anaphylactic response to that food, then you 100% have an allergy to that food. But you can use things like IgE antibodies or skin prick tests to predict that you may have an allergy to that food. But I just stress that because a lot of people spend money on those. And then they say, it's surprising, I found that I was sensitive or intolerant or allergic to these foods that I eat all the time. Mm. And that's because the IgG antibody is really just more of a recognition and memory antibody. And so now I'll sometimes say, if people, you know, they'll message me on Instagram or something and they say they got this test. And I was like, let me guess. That test said that you were intolerant to foods that you eat pretty much every day. And they're like, oh my gosh, yeah. And I was like, yeah, I'm, you know, that's because of X, Y, and Z. You know, don't use those tests. So really the best way that you can determine if you are intolerant to something is do an elimination test. And you just have to, you know, only remove that one food and then only reintroduce that one food. And then you can determine it. But I think we, and I say we, I mean, you know, even practitioners in the industry are a little bit too wholesale with things like that. Like, oh, you know, like just remove gluten or whatever. And it's like, no, some people tolerate that. And so you kind of have to, you know, really test it rather than trying to restrict unnecessarily, because people will, after those tests, like not eat their favorite foods for 6 months, and that sucks.
Mm. Yeah. And how do these food sensitivities usually come about? Like, is there a general agreed upon theory that, you know, eating too much of one thing does give you, or depriving yourself of one thing does give you an intolerance to it, because, you know, the necessary sort of gut bacteria need to break down those foods, like, don't exist because the food's not in the diet? Is it a genetic thing? Like, what's sort of the...
Is it emotional, like getting dumped while eating a steak and then you become intolerant of steak?
Well, interestingly, if you vomit after eating a food, you probably won't eat that food again.
That is true.
That's very true. Mm.
Yeah. Well, there are a few different mechanisms, and it really depends also on whether you're talking about an allergy versus an intolerance. An allergy is immune-mediated, so it's going to be some... and there are different allergic responses. You can have a food allergy to something that's been ingested. Obviously, you can have skin allergies. You can have an allergic response to things in your mouth and your esophagus. So they're mediated by different cells of the immune system. But that is actually an immune response. And it's likely that it occurs because at some point the branch of your immune system that responds to pathogens and has to like learn about how to respond to them, the adaptive immune system, accidentally labels a protein as being a pathogen. And from then on, your body recognizes that as, this is an invader, we have to attack it. So that would be the primary cause. And it could be that, you know, you had some overactive immune cells, or perhaps, you know, some theorize that it is increased gut permeability. That infants and young children actually have increased gut permeability, and so perhaps they're, you know, a greater risk of developing an allergy because so many of our immune cells exist within our gut. Now, in terms of an intolerance, you could perhaps not produce the enzyme that's required to break down that nutrient. So, you know, a lot of people are lactose intolerant, so they don't express the gene to produce the enzyme lactase that would break down the milk sugar lactose. And so the bacteria metabolize that sugar instead, and we get, you know, bubbly guts and things like that. So that's an example of an intolerance. Or if we are ingesting high amounts of those FODMAPs, the fermentable fibers, it's not necessarily that we're intolerant to all of them at any level. It's just that perhaps our gut bacteria are super fermentation happy, and so they're fermenting those fibers and causing a lot of gas and a laxative effect. So, but really that can be dose dependent, and it can also be dependent on, you know, the food itself. A couple of the most prominent FODMAPs that a lot of people are sensitive to would be garlic and onion. So usually, you know, if someone doesn't want to try the whole elimination thing, I just recommend, like, well, maybe try, you know, removing garlic and onion from your diet for a little while and see if that helps, which is a bummer because they're delicious. But, you know, it's either that or, like, pooping your brains out, you know, so give and you take.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Some people obviously also go down the path of thinking like, oh, it's not a food, it's just like a probiotic or prebiotic issue or whatever, and they just start slamming different supplements. We talked about this briefly just before the podcast. Can you give us a bit of insight as to like maybe why not these aren't necessarily the solution to like an uncomfortable gut?
Yeah. Well, I would say one of the issues with probiotic research, there is a great breadth of research. We have so many different studies on so many different bacterial strains, but we're looking at thousands of potential beneficial bacterial strains. We also may be looking at strains that, you know, people are talking about, like probiotics from soil and stuff like that. Realize that not every bacteria is going to be a beneficial bacteria, and not everything that's not pathogenic is beneficial. Some bacteria just don't seem to do anything at all. Mm. So they just hang out, but they don't actually confer a benefit to us. So to be considered probiotic, it has to be something that's been shown to confer some benefit to a host. So that's one thing to consider. These probiotics, there is no evidence that they need to enrich the gut or colonize the gut to have an effect. There also is really no evidence that they actually even live there in the gut for any amount of time after we stop taking a probiotic. So if you do take a probiotic, the effects of that probiotic are really just going to last like while you're taking it. That being said, these probiotic bacteria may exert effects just, you know, even if they come and go, they can still cause differences in gene expression in the bacteria that exist there. But it's really just such a new area of research that very little can be stated conclusively. So what we do have some substantiated claims for with probiotics are really they're strain specific and they're also disease state specific. So if you have antibiotic associated diarrhea, or an inflammatory bowel disease or irritable bowel syndrome, then you get some relief in gas, bloating, constipation, and diarrhea by taking certain strains of probiotics. There's pretty solid evidence for those, for that. There's another emerging body of research looking at the potential effects of probiotics for things like autoimmune disorders outside of the gut or mental health issues like depression and anxiety. There's very, very weak and limited evidence, especially in humans, that they're effective for that. We have seen that, you know, some of the effects of probiotics or gut changes in mice can be influenced by what we call a vagotomy. So you cut the vagus nerve, that's sort of the link between the gut and the brain. So we know that there is communication between the gut microbiome and the brain. But we can't say conclusively that, yes, there are probiotics that will help you with your anxiety or your depression or things like that. There's also another group, you know, looking at the role of probiotics in weight management. And this is what my dissertation research was on. This was in a mouse model, and they did a subsequent study in humans, too, looking at whether probiotic supplementation could be protective against weight gain during high-fat diet. And no. Those studies are limited. So we have to be really careful about what kind of claims we're making and also the context and strength of those claims. There's no reason why a healthy person should just be taking some sort of kitchen sink probiotic. If you have a disease state, you need to find the probiotic that has been used in randomized control trials to treat that disease state and take that probiotic, because bacteria do all the same things. And so it's important that we're taking the right one and realize that there's not, so a leaky, like leaky gut is really popular right now. Leaky gut is not currently a medically recognized disease state for which you take a medication or a probiotic. There are ways that we can measure gut permeability, yes, but that seems to be a really popular thing right now. People are posting all over, oh, I can't lose weight. Oh, it's your gut health. You know, you have to take a probiotic and start taking these supplements like collagen and all this, and you know, then you'll lose weight. It's a gut health thing, with really, you know, no kind of understanding of like how it all actually works, because you have dysbiosis or like an imbalanced gut microbiome. You could certainly increase your energy extraction from your diet. So you could, you know, be absorbing calories you're not aware of, but you can also have a harder time harvesting energy from the diet and then be losing weight. So we can't blame, you know, things like everything on the gut. That seems to be, that's the current scapegoat right now. Like it was carbs, now it's the gut.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you actually do any damage of taking a regular pre or probiotic that you don't necessarily need?
That is a really good question. And actually, there's some recent literature on this was a study that was done in humans. It was very invasive because they actually sampled the length of the GI tract. So that's the other issue with a lot of probiotic studies is that they're using the fecal microbiome, so the fecal microbiota, so the fecal bacteria. That is actually in recent articles has been illustrated to be significantly different from the profile of the bacteria in the gut. So it's sort of like taking a census based on people who move out of a city. So it's not necessarily giving you a picture, especially when we're looking at upper GI, like what's going on in the more proximal sections of the small intestine. If we're looking at like the duodenum, jejunum that are really close to the stomach, that's going to be really, really different from what we see in the colon and different from what we see in the fecal matter. But there was this group that looked at probiotic supplementation after taking antibiotics. And this used to, and it still is in the U.S. It's actually really common that practitioners will, you know, tell patients to, while they're taking an antibiotic, whether it's, you know, a prophylactic thing or whatever, they'll also have concurrent use of probiotics. But they found that the probiotic supplementation actually delayed establishment of that participant's previous biome. So basically, this was an 8-strain probiotic, I believe, but the few bacterial strains of that probiotic seemed to prevent growth of the native microbiota there. And lactobacillus was actually one that's really common in a lot of supplements, but that was seemed to exert the most powerful effects on the other bacteria there in preventing their growth. So that even though they are beneficial bacteria, it still isn't ideal to have low diversity. Even if you are colonized good bacteria, you still want to have a diverse microbiome, just like you want to have a diverse ecosystem. So that's one thing to consider that I thought that was really interesting. I hope that we see more studies like that where we're actually being a little bit more invasive and sampling along the intestinal tract and seeing what's actually happening in there. Because the other thing that they found was that some people were not enriched by the bacteria while others were, but their poop looked the same. So you can't necessarily look at a person's poop and say, oh yeah, you know, these bacteria have taken up residence, the probiotics are there, everyone's feces is probably going to look the same. So, you know, could you be doing damage potentially? You could certainly be doing damage to your wallet, like if you don't eat them, you know?
A lot of that happening.
Nothing there diverse in there. And I get one thing I do get confused on is, so let's say we don't need to take a probiotic, but is it still very wise or just ideal for me to be having like yogurts that have the same probiotic and like those drinks that all have probiotics in them now?
Right, like the cultured milks.
And yeah, all that different stuff, kombuchas, everything.
Yeah. Those usually are going to have a lower bacterial load, so they're going to be less concentrated than a probiotic supplement, and usually less expensive, but I guess it depends on the brand. But they're not going to probably cause or, you know, have the potential to, like, cause issues like you would see with a really potent probiotic. And they're part of, you know, what I would consider to be a nutrient-dense diet, especially when we're looking at, like, low-fat dairy, you know, you're getting calcium, vitamin D, and protein, and things like that. So, you know, do you need to go out of your way to eat them if you don't enjoy them? No, because what's really going to influence the diversity of your gut bacteria is really the diversity and the amount of plant material in your diet. So like complex carbohydrates, fruits, vegetables, getting sufficient fiber, that seems to be the main driver for bacterial diversity. And when we remove those things from the diet, we see a marked decrease in bacterial diversity and a change in the prominent strains of bacteria that we see. And this has been illustrated in randomized controlled trials and epidemiological studies in both mice and humans. So it's one of the few things that I say fairly definitively, you know, if the evidence changes my mind, okay. But right now, that's really the strongest evidence that I've seen, is that you want to be getting sufficient fiber and eating a plant-centric diet. It's not plant-only. Certainly omnivorous is fine, but making sure that you're eating whole grains, fruits, and vegetables regularly.
Mm, makes sense.
Do we see, I don't know if the studies have been done or maybe you just have your own evidence, but do we see more gut issues with people that are primarily plant-based or vegan or vegetarian and they leave out, you know, animal proteins?
We haven't looked too much into gut issues with those individuals because a lot of it has actually shown the opposite, not necessarily with vegans and vegetarians. Although they're in some of these randomized control trials, they're comparing like a carnivore diet to a vegan diet. So I think that what's important here is that we allow people to, you know, make their own dietary decisions. If a person wants to be vegan or they want to be omnivorous, that's fine. But realizing that it's really the extremes that can cause issues, perhaps for other reasons. So, you know, a vegan diet may be deficient in certain micronutrients, especially, you know, things like B12. They have to be a little bit more cognizant of. I would say that while I don't want to knock any diets, the diet that would probably be most problematic for the gut that's really popular right now would be the carnivore diet, because it's completely devoid of fiber. Now, what they found in where they looked at these dietary extremes of vegan versus complete animal products was that they had an increase in bacteria that are mucin degraders. So they actually can break down the mucus layer that is covering and protecting our intestinal cells. When that mucus layer gets really thin, bacteria can more easily interact with our intestinal cells, and then any potential pathogens and toxins can also interact with those intestinal cells. They can also more easily interact with the immune cells that exist right below those intestinal cells and between them. And that's been shown, again, in both humans and in mice, that we see this shift when we remove fiber from the diet. So the other thing that happens is that we get a decrease in the short-chain fatty acid butyrate, which is really beneficial for feeding those intestinal cells. They like to use that as energy. Mm. Butyrate can also act as an appetite regulator and help to maintain insulin sensitivity. And we see elevated levels of butyrate in people who are physically active. And so butyrate is widely recognized as being a really beneficial short-chain fatty acid. But if you're removing fiber from the diet, that means that you're not only removing fiber and butyrate, you're also removing the bacteria that would be able to ferment those short-chain fatty acids. Mm. So you're shifting the entire ecosystem to be more towards protein metabolism and not just dietary proteins, but our own bodily proteins. So I think, you know, if you're looking at the spectrum of what kind of diet is going to F up your biome the most, I would say carnivore would be at the higher
end. Probably.
They have, like I said, you know, it's not just in humans and mice. We can do really good kind of mechanistic studies, and they have been able to recover that slightly with resistant starch, which is found in potatoes and grains. So I would say, like, you know, at the very least, if you're going to have like a big fat steak, have a potato with it that's got some resistant starch in it, you know, because resistant starches are readily fermentable. But really, there's just no really reason to eat a diet like that. I mean, it's just really popular right now. It's just kind of like frustrating to see that something like that is popular because certain people are following that way of eating, that there are really no proven health benefits or anything, you know, even slightly evidence-based about that diet. Whereas if you're looking at, you know, the other extreme of a vegan diet, I think that there the micronutrient deficiency risks exist there, but not so much a risk to the microbiome because it's so full of things that bacteria like to metabolize.
So if you were on a keto diet, you say you probably sounds like you wouldn't really have those issues because you can still like fit in veggies and like a bit more diversity.
Yeah, I think that you could do a ketogenic diet in more of a gut-friendly way if you ensured that you were getting plenty of vegetables. The only issue there is that a lot of vegetables are higher in insoluble fiber, which aren't as readily fermentable. You really want to get more soluble fiber, which we can see in like our whole grains and legumes. So soluble fiber, when you put it into water, it forms like a gelatinous mass, whereas insoluble just maintains its shape. So you certainly could, you know, if you're getting insufficient vegetables, still, I think, save some of that or prevent some of the decrements that you would see with the carnivore diet. That being said, I have seen evidence in both mouse and human studies that a ketogenic style diet still reduced microbial diversity. And, you know, it could be just that there was not sufficient amounts of fiber or perhaps not the right type. But bacteria are, you know, they're a little bit finicky and they have these specific niches. And so whatever diet you are eating habitually, that's going to shape your biome. And it does it if you make a shift also, it also will adapt to that. And it does it pretty rapidly. We're really within about 24 hours is when we see some of the most emerging changes in the biome. So it happens really quickly. But they're also transient. So like even if you do, there's really only one exercise intervention study in the biome, and they found that exercise did cause some changes to the biome, but when people stopped exercising, it went back to its previous state. So it's very dynamic. It's very adaptive. And, you know, I think that just what we see overlapping every time is that what causes issues, that reduction in dietary fiber, reduction in plant matter in the diet.
Hmm. Do you think you could do some damage that you could never recover from with something like a vegan or a carnivore diet, the two sort of extremes?
Well, yes. I mean, in terms of, you know, B12 deficiency, like chronically, you store quite a lot of B12. You can get by without any dietary B12 for months. But then if you have like the neuropathy from it, you know, you're not going to recover from things like that. Now, in terms of, you know, damn it, or developing atherosclerosis. Mm. So, yes. Yeah, I think at either extreme, you could do the diet so poorly that you could cause serious health issues. But I think that eating a meat-only diet puts you at greater risk of developing health issues specifically. And that's usually, you know, what most people are concerned with. I don't know that you would, and this is just me, this is just conjecture. Mm. I don't know if you would see a complete die-off of any strain of bacteria. But I think just like our ecosystem can be so greatly affected by an extinction or very low levels of a given organism, that's what you would also see in the gut as well. It's really important to realize that these bacteria not only interact with our cells and with pathogens, they interact with each other, and they can influence the genetic expression of the bacteria around them. So if we remove one of these strains completely or get it down to incredibly low levels, that can allow for other bacteria to grow. It can allow for more pathogenic growth. And that's why it's so important to have a diverse biome. Really one of the best predictors of whether you'll be able to see a recovery of the microbiota or be able to fight off a pathogen is the diversity of the microbiome. So, and also the richness. So how many bacteria are present, and then how many different strains of bacteria are present? How many different, it's like looking at, you know, how many different species are on this planet? You know, we want it to be a diverse ecosystem. Mm. So if your diet lacks so much diversity for such a long period of time, I do think that you would have increased potential for, you know, losing out on beneficial bacteria and seeing a reduction in your mucus layer, and then, you know, potentially being at greater risk for infections.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess you could say the same about physical training as well, like the lack of diversity that you have in your training, the more you subject yourself to like chronic overuse injuries and inflammation and overtraining and that sort of thing. Like runners obviously have a ton of injuries. It's like runners have their own set of injuries, like in the injury manual that's like runner's knee, runner's hip, runner's foot, like like all this stuff, you know. So it's because they just do the one thing over and over again. There's like no diversity in their training for a lot of people. So yeah, it's just like a general principle, right? Like variety is important for just like health.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, that's really good. So just kind of wrapping, we'll get into our final four questions unless you had a gut specific question.
No, you've already gone beyond my knowledge base, so I have no follow-up
questions. I feel that way as well. We're in deep water right now. Yeah, cool. So, Gab, we've got our four questions we wrap with everyone. Our first question is, if you had an opportunity to sit down and interview anyone that is alive today, who would you sit down and interview and why?
I've had to think about this for a while because I look up to so many people in the industry. But I think that sometimes we get into this echo chamber. You know, we want to talk to people who agree with us and that we think are correct and respect. And so there are so many people that I would sit down and talk to in that respect. But I think one that I am so intrigued by, and this is sort of a class, this is sort of a class of people, but I think I would want to sit down with the food babe and ask whether she really believes some of the things that she promotes or if she's doing it because she knows that it's good for business. Because she is excellent at gaining followers. I mean, she is definitely, you know, she's business minded. But some of the things that she said, it just seems like you would be able to read really any basic textbook and know that it's not right. So that would be, you know, I don't want to sit in an echo chamber forever. I would want to sit down and talk to someone that I don't necessarily agree with, but I find intriguing.
Is this, is her name Vani Hari?
Yes, Vani
okay.
Hari.
All right, cool. I'm gonna check that out later. All right. Yeah, no, that's good. I think, yeah, you're definitely right. It's easy to sit down and interview. And I think that's probably something that the podcast, suffers from a little bit, but equally it's hard to argue over the internet on a podcast about certain things, but sharing different sides of the same coin is I think important as well. Absolutely. So great answer. So second question is, what is something, Gab, that you do every single day that you feel like is essential to the success of your day?
You know, I am almost embarrassed to say that, like, I don't really have too much of a cool routine. Like, people are like, oh, I wake up every morning and I do my yoga and then I, like, you know, look at my planner and my vision board and I meditate. Honestly, I'll be honest. I wake up, I make coffee, I sit on the couch sometimes and just, like, don't do anything. I just drink my coffee and, like, allow myself to be off for a little bit. And then usually, and I just feel like I need that. The coffee is the thing that I need. And then I will look at my planner. I've actually started using a planner with a vision board and all that.
So and then I do yoga and then meditate. But I still think it's silly.
I just don't do it in, like, a cool, structured way. But yeah, so that's been really effective. I think the only other constant that I need is gym or some form of physical activity. And like, it kind of happens at about the same time of day, but, you know, shifting from the academic lifestyle to working from home was just a feat because I was like, I have all this time. What am I supposed to do? How do I structure my day? I feel like I'm not doing enough and I'm not doing anything. And, you know, so that was tough, but I add my own structure now. So
nice.
And I do. I look at my vision board. I have it. And I look at it every day.
That's so good.
That's excellent. Great answer again. Third question is, what is something recently, Gab, that you changed your mind on that for a long time you held as a strong belief of yours?
Two things, if I can say two things.
Sure.
One, I used to recommend probiotic supplementation concurrent with antibiotics. And now, you know, in light of more invasive research, I would say that my mind has changed on that a little bit, where I would say if you're not having any symptoms, like if you're not having antibiotic associated diarrhea and everything's fine, it's probably best to maybe just watch and wait, go back to your normal diet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other thing is feeling like it's okay for me to say that I don't know something. For a long time, I felt like everyone expects me to know all this stuff. And now I've realized, you know, no one can know everything about everything.
Mm.
And it really does a disservice to whoever is following you and to yourself to think that you would be able to.
Mm. That's good. But fear not. Apparently, we spoke to... I went to a talk with Michio Kaku, who's like a future physicist, and he reckons within 8 years we'll have connected, we're basically connected our consciousness with, or the digitized version of our consciousness with the internet, and so we'll have all information at all times instantly. So we will all know everything. So.
But we'll just use it to look at cat videos on the internet.
For sure. I'll know every video.
Yeah, and Food Babe's macro planning. Yeah.